With our special guest tonight, Brother Guy Consolmagno, as we talk about the Vatican Observatory and things out there in the universe. And we're back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Brother Guy, does anybody assign you work out of the Vatican, or do you all just work on your own?
We all work on our own. The only assignment I was given when I arrived 15 years ago was do good science. And I was floored. Every time I'd worked at a university, it was what the grant would pay for. You have to get approvals. You have to fill out paperwork. Not at the Vatican Observatory. And it's because of why we exist that we have this freedom. What the Vatican wants out of us is simply proof that the Vatican supports good science. Well, that means I've got to do good science, or else what's the point of it? And that's, not as easy as it sounds. But they give me every opportunity, all the facilities I need, all the time I need, and I've got no excuse if I don't put out good science. But beyond that, no, there's no agenda. There's no, we want to look about this, we want to find out about that. It's simply, you're a scientist, you now have the freedom to follow your curiosity wherever it goes.
Do you have to report back to somebody in Rome?
At the end of the year, the observatory puts together an annual report, and we do it in Italian and in English, and just to let them know what we've been up to, who's been visiting us, who we've been visiting, what committees we've been on in terms of the International Astronomical Union or the American Astronomical Society or whatever organizations like that, just to let them know what we've been doing. But beyond that, we're participating in astronomy with exactly the same organizations as all the other astronomers at universities and observatories around the world.
Do you have to tell them, for example, you're on a national radio show? Do they care what you do like that?
I think they do, because one of the three, in 1891, when we were reconstituted, Pope Leo XIII said the reason the Vatican is going to have an observatory is to show the world that the Vatican supports real science. Here I am tonight showing the world, because of the tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of listeners you've got, now they know that the Vatican supports astronomy. They don't have to remember what my name is or what books I've written, although I wish they all would go out and buy it. That doesn't matter. What really matters is that people know that there are religious people who not only do science, we love it. It is our passion. It is our life. It is our source of joy. And it's a way that we worship the Creator.
By the way, Brother Guy, millions of listeners.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
And worldwide also, you're being listened to on the Internet in a number of different countries. England, South Korea, Australia, all over the place. Let's talk about two issues that just fascinate me. One is wormwood. In the book of Revelation, which you've read, they talk about wormwood. It sounds like an object coming from space, something coming down here. Could be part of the apocalypse. I don't know. Has the Vatican ever told you or anybody else, look for this thing?
Nope. Never. And the reason is that certainly, especially in the Catholic tradition, we are not biblical literalists. We don't insist that the Bible was, narrated to a bunch of secretaries who wrote down word for word what God had to say, and that it was all true in the sense that the owner's manual for your Toyota is true. That's not what the Bible is. It's certainly not what the book of Revelation is about. And what's fascinating about the wormwood and the other many wonderful images in the book of Revelation, a lot of them are astronomical.
Yes.
It's not that the Bible is telling us these things are happening in the sky. It's the other way around. It's that the people writing this and the people reading it know that these things happen in the sky, rare as they are, and they're saying the coming of the Lord, the coming of God into the world and into our lives is as startling and as powerful and as awful in the old sense of full of awe as anything you've ever seen coming in the sky. But they're not books about stuff in the sky. They're books about God.
Is it possible that what might have been interpreted as, religious visitations from above truly are just merely celestial events.
It's even possible that there's no mirror about it. Things that really happen, really happen. And it's not like religion that only goes on in a certain part of the world and then real life goes on elsewhere. Everything is part of our religious life, our finding God in all things. And I wouldn't want to put a barrier between the two.
So what is your interpretation of Wormwood then, Brother Guy? What do you think it is, or what do you think it meant?
I think that the writers of the Book of Revelations were trying to give strength to the people going through terrible persecutions and reminding them that God is there through these persecutions. God is there through the most startling and unsettling things you can imagine, such as, and then they describe in so many different ways, the folklore that has come down from people through millennia of things like asteroid impacts, which certainly do occur. And memory of those is a beautiful illustration. I don't think that they're predicting a specific event of a specific planet at some specific future point. I don't think that's what they were interested in when they wrote that book.
So you're not a believer in the end times?
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that you can't read this book as a map to end times, that, oh, we're going to do this, and then we're going to do that, and then we're going to do that, and they'll be exactly 1,000 years, and if you, you know, read the words backwards in a mirror, then it will get the secret knowledge. No, I'm not a believer in that. That kind of belief is called Gnosticism. It's been condemned by the Catholic Church for millennia, and it's the idea that there's secret knowledge that, you know, only you and I know about, and mm-hmm. if you give me $10, I'll clue you in on it.
No. How about five?
No. And you know that there are people who try to do science that way, that they try to keep things secret. That never works. That's a sign of science gone bad. Instead, when you discover something, you want to shout it to the mountaintop. You want to tell everybody about it, and you want it to be free, and you want it to be accessible to everyone. You don't want it hidden. You don't want it private. You don't want it copyrighted. This causes problems in the scientific world because, you know, somebody's got to pay for the internet site, somebody's got to pay for the journals. And how you manage to have this free flow of information and still pay the bills at the end of the day is a problem that we're always faced with.
I had Irvin Baxter on, heads up End Times Ministry, just on, and he's a believer that we're in the middle of end times, that things have started, the clock is ticking. Mm-hmm. Is he wrong?
I don't know. I don't think that these times are particularly better or worse than the history we've suffered through.
Do other Jesuits agree with you, or are you out there by yourself?
No. I'd say the vast majority of Catholics are of this belief that you do not know the time or the moment. And people will all be out there claiming, look at this sign, look at that sign, don't listen to them. I'm paraphrasing the Gospels when I say this. You don't know. You should live every moment as if end times were immediate and as if the universe is going to continue on so far into the future that you couldn't possibly, you know, understand it. You have to, you know, be prepared at any moment. My end time is going to come, whether it's I get run over by a truck tomorrow or I live to be 100.
So true. You might as well enjoy it.
Well, I may as well enjoy it. I may as well be ready. Either case.
Planet X. Mm-hmm. There are some who believe that there is an extra planet in our solar system. And I don't mean a little asteroid-type rock, but an extra planet of significant size that orbits this sun of ours. And some have interpreted Sumerian texts to believe that it's inhabited. Others say no. But what's your take on this so-called Planet X?
Well, certainly there's stuff out there that we're only still discovering. You know, the whole Kuiper Belt that I'm observing tonight with a telescope, we didn't even know existed 15 years ago. So to say that there was something the size of Mars that's at 100 AU away from the sun, it could be there and we wouldn't know about it. And there are some who would argue whether or not that would even be considered a planet, much the same way you argue about is Pluto a planet or Eris a planet. So certainly there's stuff out there that we don't know about. Trying to get evidence of that from ancient texts is a real questionable tech, you know, sort of approach to it, however. And the trouble is this. You think that a text from 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, that's a long time. 4,000 years is a blink of the eye in the age of the solar system. Nothing has changed in 4,000 years in the solar system.
So there's, true.
There's no reason why they would have seen something that we couldn't have seen for a planet that was, you know, out beyond Neptune. That doesn't ring true. Are there other planets that we don't know about? Certainly there are, you know, untold planets around other stars. There's still stuff in our solar system we don't know about. That's, you know, why it's still fun to keep looking. Is there life on those planets? I would be really surprised if there wasn't. But we don't have the hard evidence yet.
That's if there, and you said if there wasn't, you'd be surprised.
If there wasn't, I would be surprised, yeah.
Oh, okay. If there was a planet behind the sun, mm-hmm. is it possible we would not see it?
No. This is another great one. This is, you know, this is the source of a lot of wonderful science fiction stories. I told you.
Absolutely.
Reading science fiction. It turns out you can work out the mathematics of this. It's called the three-body problem. And even if you had another planet exactly opposite the sun so that we would never see it with visually,
right.
we would be able to detect its gravity.
Uh-huh.
It would be, displacing other planets and asteroids in such a way that we would see evidence of it. In fact, we could even see evidence of it in the way that it would displace our own planet. Just because the sun's in the way doesn't mean that it doesn't also have a gravitational effect. And the effect of that effect would be that both planets' orbits would be unstable. We wouldn't stay where we are now. We'd go flying off and run into other planets. Great idea. It doesn't work.
All right. So the planet X could be out there. Not sure, but...
The idea of finding evidence for it in Sumerian text is a little bit tougher, I think.
Have you read the work of Zechariah Sitchin?
That I don't know, no.
All right. I've got to get you to some of that just to get your impressions of his research, because according to him, these tablets and texts point out of this existence of this extra object in the solar system and some other incredible stories. I mean, visitations from this planet, coming down here, seeding mankind, literally creating Adam and Eve. I mean, it's just incredible stuff, Brother Guy.
Well, there's also, you know, did you ever see the movie Galaxy Quest?
Yes.
And, you know, the characters pick up what is essentially Star Trek, and they think it's documentaries. You know, who knows what our civilization is going to look like to people 3,000 years from now? What in the world are they going to make of us?
What about the fact that we could have a binary star system along with our star?
Again, the best evidence for that, both for and against, is the effect of gravity. And there are some people, legitimate scientists, good scientists, who have been looking for periodicities in comet showers and trying to use that as evidence of there being some other dim star that is, you know, throwing things our way. Other people saying the evidence really doesn't hold up. I'd say the consensus view at the moment is probably not, but it's one of those ideas you always keep in the back of your mind in case something new comes along, it's a new bit of evidence.
Familiar with work of the late... Emmanuel Velikovsky?
Oh, yes. I read that stuff in the science fiction library at MIT.
Worlds in Collision. What'd you think?
He was not a very good scientist, I'm afraid. He was a very imaginative person. And I think he probably inspired a lot of people to think in new and different ways.
You don't think Venus is a captured comet, then, huh?
No. We know a whole lot more about Venus than he did. We know a whole lot more about comets than he did, which is only fair. He was writing 50 years ago. And it doesn't work. On the other hand, we also do know now, in ways that we didn't know 50 years ago, that the solar system is not as stable as we thought, that planets in the past have moved their positions, just not the way he worked it out. So, you know, he's not totally crazy. It's just the details that he came up with and trying to tie it in with biblical writings of 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Doesn't work out nearly as neatly as he hoped. But, hey, the same could be said about my master's thesis, that it didn't turn out to be as neat as I thought, too. That's what science is about. It's coming up with interesting ideas, trying out ways of testing them, and if things work, then you say, okay, let's go a little bit further. And if they don't work, they go, well, now I've learned something.
What's the latest of this British newspaper story, somewhat tabloid, talking about the Vatican Observatory and that you're all being kicked out or something?
Yes. What is that? Well, the irony is, in fact, it wasn't a tabloid. It was actually a quite serious newspaper called The Independent.
Really?
But British newspapers do have a lot of the tabloid in them at times, I'm afraid.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
It's funny. In America, you know, some TV news is pretty awful, but at least you can trust the newspapers. In Britain, the TV news is generally pretty good, and some of the newspapers are pretty wild. What had happened was this. A couple of years ago, for 10 or 15 years, we've been looking at the future of the observatory. The Vatican's been looking at how we're using space. And we've been negotiating, would it be better if we had our own separate building rather than sharing quarters with us in the same building as the Pope? If we had our own separate quarters, newly refurbished with, you know, electric plugs that are the same in every room. If
you've
lived in Europe, you know what I mean. The plugs are different from plug to plug. Wired for the internet, which, of course, they didn't know in 1590 when they built the building we're in now. So we finally worked out that we're going to take over a building in the gardens right next to the Pope's quarters, completely refurbished. We're looking forward to it. It's going to be a great sight. A British journalist saw this and said, aha, I knew the Pope was always anti-science, so he says. I knew this must be it. He saw a plot.
And he's talking about what, Benedict the 16th?
Benedict the 16th, of course, has been fantastic to us. He's done great things for us. But, you know, it didn't fit his preconceptions. And, of course, the British have had an interesting history with the popes, let's say. So they're always happy to see a conspiracy when there is none.
Well, no doubt. I've been watching on Showtime every once in a while, the Tudors.
Exactly.
They didn't like the Pope at all.
Exactly. And you know, things, they're still a little shaky after all this time. Well, the guy wrote us and said, you know, so what's the story? Can you tell us the scoop? And we wrote back saying, well, we're not being kicked out. You know, we're looking forward to expanding our quarters. He didn't like that. So a few weeks later, this all, you know, a year after the decision had been made, he writes this article, and it's picked up by, of course, it gets on the internet. Once it gets on the internet, everybody assumes it's the truth.
Yeah.
Well, there are a couple of other things he says in the article which should have been red flags. Like he says, for instance, the work of the Vatican Observatory is to explain the Star of Bethlehem. You're going, what? You know, I have no expertise in the Star of Bethlehem. Nobody in our group does. It's the last thing in the world we're interested in. It's, you know, that's a historian's job. It's not an astronomer's job. But it was clear that he didn't really know what he was talking about, but he got picked up by the internet, and the next thing you know, people are writing us letters, oh, so sorry, here you've been kicked out. And you're going, well, actually, if you saw the quarters, you would love to be kicked out. You know, it's a beautiful building in a garden, surrounding a garden, as only the Italians can do. There are, you know, fruit trees. You can practically lean out the room that's going to be my lab and pick the fruit off the tree. And it's still in Castel Gandolfo. It's still in one of the most beautiful little villages in Italy.
So you're not being kicked out?
Anything but. The Vatican is putting up a large chunk of money. I don't know the amount, but it's considerable, to renovate this place, to equip it with all that we need. And the Cardinal Loyola, who is essentially the mayor of Vatican City, has said, we want this to be a showcase, just to demonstrate to the world how much the Vatican supports science.
We're
getting first-class quarters.
State-of-the-art.
State-of-the-art, you bet.
All right. Well, we'll be state-of-the-art in just a moment. As we come right back, I want to chat with you more about meteorites, see what's new out there in the world of planetary science as well. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines and give you an opportunity to talk with Brother Guy. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Now, don't forget this Friday during our Friday night into Saturday morning open lines, and I always look forward to Friday nights. I'm going to ask that question again about where that line, I'm a fan of man, came from, what movie. We're now up to 8 books I'm giving away to those of you, any one of you, who gets that line correct and names the movie. Now, you can go to NighthawkZone.com. NighthawkZone.com, click the live zone, and then on one of their pages, it'll probably be page number, 5, 6, 7, something like that. Someone tonight we'll put the name of that movie so you can get there in case you call in and I ask you that question. A Phantom Inn, and what movie was that from? We're up to 8 books, great books. Books that, for example, like Brother Guy has written, God's Mechanics. These are books that the guests send me, I read, and then I want to give them out to you. So go to NighthawkZone.com. They'll post up there tonight under Live Zone on one of the pages during their chat tonight. The name of that movie. I want someone to win it this weekend. Anyway, I'll be back in a moment, more with Brother Guy in a moment before next hour, and we'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Brother Guy, when we first met over the phone, we talked about your book, God's Mechanics. Lots of new listeners joining us all the time. Let's talk a little bit about that as well. How's it going? How was it received?
It's been very well received. Sales are nice, which is always pleasant. You have to say that the sales after my last appearance here went through the roof on Amazon.com. So I believe you. You've got millions of listeners.
And they're devoted and they love science. They truly love science.
They really do. A lot of them emailed me, which was great fun. It's apparently there's some foreign language versions that are being produced now. I've had a lot of interesting response from other scientists, including a couple who have become converts to, not because of my book, but you know, having read the book, they said, "Ah, what you're talking about is the same thing that I went through," they tell me. Which means it's not just me, I'm not just, you know, crazy, though I may be, that I think it was able to reflect the deeper issue of what it's like to be a scientist or an engineer, to be a techie, and to have this very practical view of the universe. You know, instead of wondering what's beautiful, you just want to know, how does it work? Where are the gears and levers? And to take that attitude to that way of looking at the universe to the bigger religious question. Why am I here? Why is there something instead of nothing? You know, is there something I'm supposed to be doing here? And if so, how come nobody told me about it?
You know, I believe after mixing real science with my own belief system that we're here for a purpose. We're here to develop ourselves. And the physical part of all this is really the shell of what we're really supposed to be doing. And the splendor of it, the beauty of it, what you bring to the table, Brother Guy, through astronomy, you know, I think is part of this magnificence, which allows us to perfect ourselves for whatever is on the other side.
You know, you were talking before about the Hubble images. The word you just used there, beauty, is what comes to me. Of all of the Hubble images, have you ever seen one that was not beautiful?
They're all phenomenal. And now, there's one that knocks my socks off, and that's the deep space one where they aimed it into the vastness of nothing,
and they got thousands of galaxies.
I just can't handle that one. It's too good.
Oh, it's wonderful. And that's, you know, why am I an astronomer? Why do I spend my life doing this when I could be on the stock market or I could write, you know, science fiction novels? It's for the love of it. It's for satisfying the curiosity of it. It's something that's extremely human. It's one of the things that makes it. I've got to tell you a story. When I was 30 years old, I was a postdoctoral fellow at MIT, years before I was a Jesuit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd wake up at 3 in the morning and turn on the radio, and you know, I don't know if you were broadcasting in those days, but...
I was broadcasting with Marconi.
Well, you know...
I was the one on the other end.
Got it. Well, you know, I'm wondering, 3 in the morning, lying in bed... Why am I doing astronomy when people are starving in the world? And it just seems so pointless. So I quit astronomy. I listened to one of those public service ads and joined the Peace Corps. And they sent me to Africa. And I said, I'll go anywhere you want, do anything you want. So they sent me to go to the University of Nairobi and teach astronomy. The very thing that I thought was pointless, the people in Africa recognized, was not at all pointless.
Synchronicity.
And that sense of, you know, wondering who we are, that's what makes us a human being.
Yeah.
That sense of trying to understand how it all fits together, that's what makes us different from just a well-fed cat or a dog. And to deny that to somebody just because they're poor, just because they were born in the wrong continent, it's to deny them their humanity. You can't do that.
When I was a little boy, my parents signed me up to an astronomy club. Because they had purchased a 3-inch telescope for me. And this old guy who owned the store, you know, it was one of those great little things like you see in the movies where you go into the shop that this old guy has with dusty books on the bookshelves.
Oh, yeah.
And it's dark and dingy, and he's in there. You know, he's got a globe, and then he's got, you know, charts of the universe and the star systems. Anyways, he sells telescopes. And then he had, like, on every Tuesday night, he'd have an astronomy club, and, you know, and adults and kids would go there, and we would just talk astronomy. Well, they bought me for my birthday this 3-inch telescope, and I will always remember two things. One from this little old guy who took the wooden tripod legs of this telescope, and he said, I'm gonna do this for you, and it's gonna be really cool. He spray painted it black, the legs of the wooden tripod, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then he took his paintbrush, dipped it in white paint, and flicked it at the tripod legs so they looked like little stars.
Yes.
And I will always remember that, because in Detroit, looking out there at 3 or 4 in the morning on a freezing morning, I mean like 10 degrees above zero, I will always be able to see that tripod and how the moonlight would reflect off those little specks that he would do. But to me, the one thing that just opened my eyes up to the entire vastness of this solar system and the universe, but to me, what was the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen through telescope, and this is, you know, through a young kid's eyes, was when I first looked through a telescope at Saturn. And I saw those rings, and you know what? I was never the same.
Mm-hmm.
Never the same.
That's one of the important things about astronomy, that you can see it yourself. You don't have to listen to some expert. Nobody listening to this radio show has to take my word for what the sky looks like. You can walk outside and see it for yourself. Of course, it's tougher now with all the city lights. I think that's, you know, the Dark Sky Association trying to make sure that we don't blind ourselves. A crazy thing happened in 1994. The Northridge earthquake in Los Angeles occurred 5 in the morning on a January morning. The next week, the Griffith Planetarium get hundreds of phone calls. Why did the earthquake make the sky so frightening? You go, wait a minute, this earthquake had nothing to do with the sky, except it turned all the lights out, and everybody had rushed out of their houses during the earthquake, and for the first time, they saw what the sky actually looks like. Too many people have lost
it. It's gorgeous. Absolutely.
It really is.
You know, we almost lost Griffith last year in fires. Very, very close.
There's one other Detroit love and astronomy story that I just have to throw at you. There's a fellow who works here in Arizona now as a professional astronomer. When he was a young man, he was engaged to be married, and he was also an amateur astronomer. His wife-to-be said, "You're spending too much time with the telescope and not enough with me. So it's me or the telescope."
No.
Well, he swallowed hard, and he ran an ad in the Detroit Free Press, telescope for sale. Young woman bought the telescope. He dumped his fiance and ran off with the young woman. They're now been married 30 years.
I love it. Can you believe that? And he was 2-for-1 for him.
Absolutely. I've seen them. They still have the telescope, but she says, "It's mine, you know. It's not."
What, was it love at first sight for him?
Pretty much, I guess, yeah.
That is something. That is something. Well, at least he wasn't using the telescope to peer through her home.
No need for that, no.
Wow, that's it. Wait, what's new in the world of planetary science these days?
Well, there's always great new things happening. I think the number of extra solar planets is approaching 200, may even have passed 200 by the last I looked, which means there are, you know, 200 stars nearby that we now know are solar systems. And again, 10 years ago, we hadn't, you know, 15 years ago, we didn't even know about one. To me, one of the more exciting things is a theoretical model based on very good astronomy that can tie in with things you can observe today about what happened in our own solar system 4.5 billion years ago, just as the planets were forming. Now, we've all learned as kids the names of the planets and the order that they are. So you've got Mercury on out to Uranus and Neptune, mm-hmm. So the major planets, you know, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. And they're so big, and they're in such stable, nearly round orbits that it would be hard to see how they could have been formed anywhere except there. But the modelers, with wonderful computer models looking at the gravity in the early solar system, have realized that as Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune were being formed, a lot of smaller icy bodies were also being formed. In the outer solar system, as Uranus and Neptune were being formed, their gravity caused a lot of comets to come cascading in to the inner solar system. And that's possibly the source of the heavy cratering that you see on the older parts of Mars, on most of the Moon, and probably what brought a lot of water and carbon material onto the Earth. But as those comets came in, Uranus and Neptune moved out. And you can see evidence of that because Neptune, as it moved out, would collect other bodies in a resonant orbit with them and move them out as it moved out. So now there's a whole collection of bodies in orbit with Neptune or at, you know, three halves resonance with Neptune, including Pluto. Neptune was the big body. Pluto just got caught up in the sweep. But the idea that these bodies moved outwards from their original location is a startling new idea. At the same time, Jupiter is forming, and material inside Jupiter gets ejected outwards to form the Oort cloud, the place where comets come from today. Well, as that moves out, Jupiter must move in. As Jupiter moves in, it sweeps away all the material in almost all the material in what's now the asteroid belt. That's why there's no planet there, even though Bode's law would predict there would be a planet. This one new idea of planets migrating in and out suddenly has the power to explain a lot of the crazy things that we never understood before about the solar system. And so far, it all seems to hang together.
What do you think of Mars? What kind of life do you think Mars once had?
Oh, wow. It's possible that Mars once had a much thicker atmosphere. It's possible that the northern half of Mars was covered with oceans. That's very controversial. There are people who insist it's true, other people who insist it isn't. And I'm not knowledgeable enough of the evidence to argue one way or the other. It's possible that Mars could have been teeming with life at one point.
Much like Earth.
Or even more than Earth. It's also possible that it never had life, in spite of all of that. And here's the argument why it would never have life. You see, on Earth, when life occurred, the first thing it did was to gobble up the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and turn it into oxygen. And, it, you know, in the essence, it extincted one type of life, the oxygen, the kind that would be poisoned by oxygen.
Right.
And
right.
It allowed another, it's 2 a.m, I'm spacing on the words here. Anaerobic was the word I was looking for.
Try being up every night doing this.
Oh, boy. And it developed a new kind of life that thrives on oxygen. But once that happened, the chemistry of planet Earth was never going to be the same. That did not happen on Mars. So either Mars didn't have life the way that the Earth did, or Mars had a kind of life that never developed as far or never developed in the same way that Earth life did. We just don't know. We'll never know until we actually go there.
Well, that's true, because if it did develop life in a different way, is it possible that it could still be there, or some of it is there?
Probably not on the surface. You know, the lamps that hospitals use to sterilize equipment,
yes,
they use ultraviolet light. There's more ultraviolet hitting the surface of Mars than there are in those chambers in hospitals.
Right.
So the surface of Mars is sterilized. But you don't have to get that far below the surface where you could have cracks that microbes can live in. We know that microbes live in cracks in rocks in Antarctica.
Or strange little animals in caves.
Or plant life.
Who knows?
And you don't know until you go there. On the other hand, once you do go there, human beings tend to leak E. coli and other sorts of bacteria every place we go. So the danger is if you send somebody there, they'll find life, but it will be life they brought with them from Earth.
Then again, the life here could have been from Mars.
Which is also possible. So all of these possibilities are staring us in the face. Some of them are going to turn out to be true. Some of them are going to turn out to be bad ideas. But even the bad ideas can spark new ideas that eventually get you towards the truth.
Are physicists also astronomers, and are astronomers physicists?
Physicists do lots of different things, and some of it is astronomy. Astronomers do a lot of different things, including using physics.
Yes.
So the question is, what's the tool and what's the goal? To a physicist, simply knowing how the universe physically works is the goal. To the astronomer, we take what the physicists have worked out in order to try to understand the things we're looking at in our telescopes. So for one person, it's the end product, and for the other person, it's the goal. It's like, does the guy building the race car, is his job done when the race car is built, or is his job done when somebody gets in the car and actually drives it in a race?
And do you need to finish and win that race?
For some people, well, you know, I've got three friends who are great athletes, and one of them has to win because he just is driven to win. And another person wins because it would be inelegant to lose. You know, it depends on where your competition is and what drives you. You don't have to be a winner and a loser in science. What you do have to have is that sense of joy that comes from when you see something on your computer screen that you didn't know a moment earlier and that you know nobody else knew before, and you just can't wait to tell them about it.
What's the strangest thing you have ever seen in a meteorite deposit? Markings, anything?
There are so many odd things in meteorites that I don't really know where to begin. There are types of iron meteorites where, you know, the iron looks like it was molten, and it's cheek by jowl against rock that looks like it's never been hot. How do you do that? How do you do that?
That's weird.
I don't know. It's very weird. There's a lot of meteorites that everybody knows are there, and everybody knows they're really strange, and we're just putting them over to the side right now because we don't even know where to begin.
Have we ever found one that had some kind of inscriptions on it or anything like that?
Nothing quite like that.
I had to ask. You never know.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, the meteorites that are in labs now, the style 100 years ago was to write the name of the meteorite in acid on the meteorite. So you could say, boy, how did they know in outer space where this thing was going to land?
If the name Arne Saknussemm was on the meteorite, do you know what movie that would have been from?
Ooh. It's on the tip of my tongue, and I'm missing it.
Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Of course. Of course.
That's where James Mason and Pat Boone found
that
rock.
Right. Yes.
They chipped it open, and that was his initials or something that he had on there.
Right.
And of course, another great movie.
It was. And, of course, Journey to the Center of the Earth was mentioned in the third Back to the Future movie.
Exactly.
So it all ties together. You know, science fiction to me is really important because it's the place where I can play with these ideas. And that sense of imagination is so important when you're a scientist. It's funny, people think if you're a scientist, you just have to be good in math. Well, yeah, that helps. But you have to have a sense of imagination. You have to have a sense of dreaming. Because
You've got to write a science fiction book.
Oh, if only I could write fiction.
Well, work on that. We'll be back in a moment. It's time for phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.